Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Whirl with Merle, and I'm your host, Merle Exit. I'm here. Wait, okay. It is about 8 p.m., and I'm here on Long Island, as they say it. Not the Long Islanders, though. I guess the New York Cityers. But I'm here on Garden City Hotel in Garden City, Long Island. And this is phenomenal. This hotel is just wonderful. It's a Victorian, old Victorian with the modern touches, you know, the flat screen TV, et cetera, of course. It's I have access to the internet. I'm right in my room. Yes, no, I have clothes on. So don't worry, I'm not naked. But even if I was, you can't tell anyhow. So, anyway, I have to tell, this is, before I get into this whole thing about the hotel, I have to tell you about what's going to be going on this evening. I have, last week I was talking about the eastern township of the province of Quebec, and just basically we didn't really get into the press trip that I took. And so Denis Beliveau is going to be calling in, and we're going to go through the itinerary and talk about what we did. And, whoa, this is going to be cool. I have filmmaker Matthew Krause that's going to be calling in later. We're going to talk about this movie called How Ohio Pulled It Off. Oh, yes, the presidential election rigged. Well, according to the movie, it certainly is, and he'll talk about it, and who knows what's going to happen this presidential election. And then I have Jamie Kenny from the Jewish Heritage Museum in downtown Manhattan, and she'll be calling in. We'll be talking about that. So let me tell you a bit about, first I have to tell you, oh, goodness gracious, I feel like I need to, like, I'll roll out of this place. I just had dinner because I was wondering, they have a place, the Polo restaurant here, and I kept inhaling. It's such a big deal. Everybody told me it's such a big deal. Yeah. And I wanted to see if it really was, and so I dined there, and it really is. Now I understand why it got such high ratings. Fuck the Zagat survey. It got high ratings by me. You know, that's what really counts. But, and I'll go into in a minute as to what I ate, but I have to tell you what was so funny. I mean, I'm so stuffed because it seems every time I've, like, walked out of the room, I come back and there's little things of food on trays here for me. And first we started today, I was asking for some assistance with dealing with Wi-Fi here with my laptop, and then, you know, I get the knock on the door. I'm thinking it's the guy helping with the laptop, and there's this guy standing there with a tray of fruit and a bottle of water, and I'm looking at the guy, staring at him, going, thinking to myself, what does he have to do with the internet? You know, poor man, he's just standing there. He finally decided to say to me, can I come in? You know, so here I had this wonderful fruit sitting there, and I had to go back out and come back upstairs, and there's these little tiny hors d'oeuvres what they call, well, they're not amuse-bouches. They're just a little more than it tastes. And there was this, I had to, like, ask afterwards what they were, and it was like, let's say, apple chestnut soup with duck confit, fresh figs with Herbistan or Huberstan blue goat cheese, Sereno ham, and truffle grape honey. Then there was lamb terrine with apricots and cornichons, or cornicons, I don't know. And the last thing, black plum and pomegranate salad with mint. Now, these were little tiny, like almost each of them with maybe like 2 bites worth, except the apple chestnut soup. It was like in one of those, like almost like a shot glass of that. And so, I had time, thank goodness, to walk that off and take a tour of the hotel. And just after dinner, I decided to forego dessert because I'm going to the Rain restaurant after the lounge. It's another restaurant, a lounge, I guess, after I do my show. And I decided, that at that time, I'll sit and relax, have a tea, and have dessert. I come up to my room. There's this little tray of dessert little things, mostly chocolate, which I'm a total fan of, and this little bottle of, I don't know what kind, I guess whatever, an after-dinner booze kind of thing, which I probably won't have. And I'm just thinking, there's no way I can, they're expecting me for dessert, so, I want to do that. But in the meantime, as I'm waiting for Denny to call in, I just, want to quickly tell you, what I ate. First, an amuse-bouche did come out, and that amuse-bouche was something with an oxtail croquette with pickled radish atop of it. And then I had my appetizer, and that's the dessert there. The appetizer I had was a warm lobster salad versus the cold one with cardamom, braised leeks, haricot verts. I know I'm pronouncing it incorrectly. Haricot vert. I'm sorry, I can go to Quebec very often, but I still can't pronounce French. String beans, that's what haricot vert are. And a louvage vinaigrette. Well, whatever it was. It was absolutely fabulous. Then as my entree, I'll probably belch a few times while I eat. And if I do, you'll have to excuse me. But I probably meant to fart instead. Let's see. Pine nut and preserved... Pine nut and preserved lemon-crusted lamb chops with endive marmalade, root vegetable puree, and purple mustard sauce. Now, I know there was, what's that stuff? We saw the endive, the one that tastes like licorice, that fennel, yes. With fennel in there, too. Root vegetable puree. I thought it was, it tastes like kind of mashed potatoes kind of thing. But, oh, God, that was so really good. And then, I didn't have enough. They didn't think I had enough. In between, how came? I wasn't sure what happened. This is before I had the lamb chop. Out came a quail. God, it was quail. Now, what did they do with the quail? It was quail with couscous. Yes, quail with couscous. Wow. But what I liked about the restaurant, interesting things. First of all, you could tell, I mean, this is class. This is class. There wasn't a salt and pepper shaker. There was these little containers, and you put your spoon in, and you had either pepper, one for pepper, and one for sea salt. Sea salt. Then they had breads, and I usually don't eat bread, but it was this focaccia, pumpernickel raisin, black olive, and I just, for the heck of it, asked, they make their own breads. They make their own desserts. They make their own breads. And then I wanted to have something to drink. I didn't want to have any liquor. They gave me these combination of fruit juices, and all the fruit juices are fresh squeezed. No concentrate, no, you know, whatever. It was, I mean, come on, that's class. And I have to say, they don't, I mean, you can't, don't expect specials on this, on their menu, because everything that's on the menu is special. But I am so full. This is going to be a tough show to get through, but I will do it anyway. And let's see. But I'm going to take my usual break. Yes, I didn't finish them. No, I didn't finish them. They're still in my house. I may need a new supply, though. Come on.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale.
Yes, and you can get them at brownies.com. And I mean, if they're brownies, if they're not even great at this point, like the best damn brownies I've ever had, they've just come out with truffle brownies. In other words, they've taken the damn brownies and they've enrobed it with Belgian chocolate. I mean, this is killer. As I look across and see all this chocolate sitting there waiting for me, and I'm going, I can't do it. I can't put another thing in my stomach. I had a lot of water with my meal. So anyway, and I took a tour of this place. I went downstairs. They have an exercise room. They have a lot of equipment. And I briefly met Keith, and I got just a kind of quick tour of the place, and they had those, I guess those big balls that they have that you exercise on and stuff, you know. When I get back, I'm gonna have to come back here because I want to tell you about. Because it's not just that the Polo restaurant has the reputation just for, like, the dinner kind of stuff, but they have this big reputation for the Sunday brunch. And I hear it's the most outrageous Sunday brunch going. I was told there's things like sushi and lobster and, you know, plus all the other goodies that, you know. So I can understand, you know, why it's packed. I don't know what the cost is yet. But I got some other things while I'm waiting. Denny, where are you, Denny? Okay, Rain Bar. This is some presidential candidate menu to honor the 10-15 Hofstra debate. Oh, yeah. Well, we'll we'll see if Hero there doesn't call off that debate, try to not do it. The debate on which I understand is, I think it's supposed to be the last debate. I'm not sure, but on October 15th, the debate is out here, and it's not in this hotel, but it's at Hofstra, which is just like, you know, kind of down the block kind of thing from here. So they're having some special menus to kick off debate week. Stars and Stripes, $34.95 prefix menu. I always look at going prefix. Prefix menu of candidates' favorites from October 11th to 18th. So let's see what they have here. Appetizers like Alaskan King Crab Nacho Stacks. Obama's personal chili recipe a la De Bruin. De Bruin. Well, Stephen Bruin is the, I believe, that's, let me write, make sure they got his last name correct. I don't want Steve. Yeah, Bruin. He's the chef here. McCain baby back ribs, Biden's chicken pot pie. Campaign bus, homemade donuts, deep dish Chicago style, pumpkin pie. Cocktails, they have the blue party martini. Bacardi limon, blue curacao, and pineapple juice. That sounds a little like a shark kind of thing. So that's what that's something, one of the things they do. Oh, some other names of cocktails. Obama Slama. I don't know why that. Okay. Grey Goose Citron Vodka, Southern Comfort, Blue Curacao, Amaretto Di Sarno, gin topped with orange juice and garnished with orange slice and cherry. I would take a sip and fall to the floor with that one there. Oh, by the way, the Garden City Hotel is, phone number there is 516, phone number there, phone number here, 516-747-3000. Yeah, Google it. I mean, or now I don't, not, now it's no more Google. I mean, not no more Google. But now the cool, C-U-I-L, is the newest thing. And let's see what else they have. I'm telling you, after this, I'm going to have to, after dinner or after tonight, I'm going to have to go down to that exercise room and check out Keith's balls. I'm telling you. Let me see what else. Oh, so the Polo Restaurant is another Polo Restaurant. That's the one. It's going to have a new $49 prefix menu. Isn't it interesting? Like, you know, like, it's funny how, you know, how years ago you did with the $50, you know, for dinner would have been like, are you kidding? Where do you think I am, you know? But it's almost kind of, you know, common now. Although I have to say that, Chef Stephen De Bruin, B-R-U-Y-N, he's actually from Belgium. He's from Belgium, yes. Yeah, we had, we chatted during dinner. And so what are they going to have? Let's see, appetizers. What looks good? Garden vegetable salad with a savory beet. Sablé, cookie, and Vermont constant bliss cheese. I love the way, you know, like, I should probably do that, like, you know, when I order, is to say that, you know, I would like to have the coconut corn chowder with bay scallops, Thai basil, and shiitake mushrooms. But they always have even more descriptive, you know. I would like to do that sometime with the waiter. By the way, when the waiter comes over, and this is another thing I like doing. The waiter comes over and always says, "Hi, my name is Steve, and I'll be your waiter." And I say, "Hi, my name is Merle. I'll be your patron." Try that. Give them a little bit of a laugh. So, let's see what else here. I can't imagine that, you know, like what this place is going to be in this area when they have the debate going on. The Hofstra, that's which is like Mitchell Field is here, and Mitchell Field years ago was one of those aviation things. As a matter of fact, they have, and this is what I did today. The choice is here. I mean, in this area, I took the Long Island Railroad, which was so much easier than the Garden City Hotel is right across the street. So I took the Long Island Railroad, and I hopped over to the Cradle of Aviation Museum, which I did go like a long time ago, and it was really good. And like some few hands-on stuff, a simulated thing. It's really it's great. It's great for kids, and great for grown-ups who are interested in planes and you know, historic stuff. And all of the planes, everything that there relates to something having to do with Long Island. They also have an IMAX theater, which they should rightly call OmniMax, because IMAX is when you have, at least I see it, IMAX is when you have those big screens and it's like just one like flat kind of thing. This one is like encompasses your whole, just about your entire peripheral vision. It was so weird. And I saw the movie, let's see, Fly Me to the Moon, which is a animated movie about some flies who go to the moon with some astronauts, Apollo 11, with the one small step, one giant leap. And it was kind of cute. I was with my friend Nancy. Nancy, I guess, yeah, we somewhat have the same sense of humor, but she didn't laugh at, you know, at one point. I know it was, like, disgusting, but I just thought it was really funny. They would do this thing that Amelia Earhart was flying, and she's falling asleep, and there was a fly with her. And she's just, and because of falling asleep, she almost crashes. But the fly, to wake her up, flies up her nose, her nostril. And Amelia Earhart sneezes. And the next thing you see the fly is like against the wall. With all the snot. I thought it was hysterical. Nancy looked at me and wondered why I laughed. I mean, like, you know, yes, it's so childish, but that's the whole point in watching a childish movie. Let's see. So I enjoyed it, though. And they also have a children's museum. They also have a right down the block from there, they also have a firefighter museum inside this, the Cradle of Aviation Museum. So Anyway, and if the that's kind of a stuff for like you know children and adults who feel like being children or whatever. Otherwise, this entire area is an absolutely shock to your drop. Absolutely, I don't think there's anything around this area that you can't buy. It was between malls and everything else. I'm still waiting. I don't know what happened with Denny, whether Denny forgot or. But what I'm going to do, I'll talk about it in a second. But before I talk about it, oh, here's a perfect song because it's Quebec.
Once more, you open
Yes, Celine Dion. So I'll start to tell you about the trip. And if Dani doesn't call in, I'll talk about it a later time because there was a lot. So after we got picked up at the airport and were greeted with some boxed lunch, we then drove to the auberge. Auberge and Spa West Brome. It's in Sud Lac Brome, Quebec. So you get what happens with these the auberges is that you have dinner. Dinner and breakfast is included when you stay at these places. And the places we stayed at, I mean, none of them were like, you know, that the food sucked or anything. You know, that they really did a great job on the food, too. And so I had a room, a suite. It had a kitchenette, which didn't do me any good because I had nothing to cook. Fireplace was too warm for that. A private balcony, which was that was nice. I like to have like that to sit out there, and it's very very peaceful there. And so it's kind of like rustic as far as where we ate. It was kind of rustic, but where we slept was really great. And, oh, they have a spa. Yeah, they have a wonderful spa with all kinds of treatments. And they also have a pool. And the pool has salt in it versus that shit that you put in the pool, you know. Yeah, you know. Yeah, that. Yeah. Thanks. And then, so from there, you know, so we had dinner. I skipped breakfast, and I skipped breakfast not because I out of hunger, not hunger, but it was absolutely pouring and extremely windy, and I decided it wasn't worth breakfast to do that. So then we were off to Missisquoi. Let's see, MUSEEMISSISQUOI.ca. This was the three 19th century buildings that retell the life of the pioneers and the history of the county of Missisquoi and the surrounding areas. So there were a whole bunch of kind of different exhibits and, you know, things like that. And I think it said they have 12,000 historic objects there. And they have the Cornell Grain Mill. I don't think the mill wasn't working, but you could see the mill. And then from there, we walked over to Hodges General Store and the old Bill's Barn. Now, the Hodges General Store was, you know, like the old-time stuff, that things that were in there. All historic, hysteric, historic. But now, hey, you know, half an hour went by. No, 15 minutes has gone by. Time to eat. So now we're off to this place. Vignoble de l'Orpelier. God. Zinobre, I don't know, whatever. La Orpailleur, O-R-P-A-I-L-L-E-U-R. It's in the town of Dunham in the Eastern Townships, which is very close to the American border. And we did a wine tasting. Yeah. Now, twist our arms. Yeah, we did a wine tasting. And, that's right, because one of the things that we had with dinner the night before, it came out with this, ice wine that was really delicious. And I think, I'm not sure where it came from. No, it didn't come from this place. But that we had it on different ice wine for the tasting. And ice wine is, go look it up. I don't feel like explaining what ice wine is, but it's, let's just say it's very sweet, and sometimes can be extremely tasty. So that's what we did. We had this wine tasting. And from there we departed for the town or whatever of Knowlton, K-N-O-W-L-T-O-N. And we had lunch. We had lunch at the Auberge Knowlton. It's called Relais Restaurant. Relais. And what did we eat there? Excuse me, I meant to fart. I don't remember what we ate. I remember we did a tasting. I did a platter. There was a platter of like local little goodies that we had. And I probably, I'm sure I had duck. That was this big thing. God, I forgot. Oh, boy, I'll try it, I'll do it. No, Donald, no. We didn't eat you. We ate some.
Oh, yes, you went.
No, we didn't eat anybody you know. It wasn't a relative. I mean, you don't have relatives all over the world. No, you don't. Come on. Don't be silly. But that was this thing going on. Everybody was having duck all over the place in the Eastern Township. So at this time, let's see. Oh, because the night before, that's right. That's what I had for dinner. I had duck confit. For dinner. So this time I had duck breasts for lunch. But I guess we were supposed to go to some cafe, but they decided to have us at the Auberge Knowlton instead. And then from there, we went to this place, Joy de Lavende. Joy, J-O-I-E, de Lavende. L-A-V-A-N-D-E. Anyway, this place, they grow lavender. They have fields of lavender. And they had two ducks running around. Or they had fields of lavender. Oh, how gay. I was wondering, I mean, because the smell was great. They make all kinds of lavender stuff and, you know, things like that. And I think my bag still smells of lavender because I shoved the plant in there. And probably didn't declare it on the way home. It wasn't a whole big plant. It was just a little piece of a plant, you know, wonderful little smell. And then we, from there, we went to another Museum Historique du Comté de Brome County Museum. This one had five buildings of centuries past. Had military collections. Oh, they had the, yeah, you can go fuck yourself there because they had the World War Fokker. DV-11 plane. I don't think it means DV-11, does it mean? Was that supposed to be the year, which is called DV-11. And then so we got to see that and more, you know, relics from related to the Loyalists. And what they call the Amerindians. And Oh, there they had. That's right. There was a recreation of a general store in a courthouse, too. So there now, we didn't eat there, but we're ready to eat again, I guess. I mean, 15 minutes, you know, the old thing going by. We had free time in Knowlton, which was fabulous since everything was closed. It was on a Monday, and either they were closed because it's Monday, or they close at 5 o'clock. So I'm not sure what they really have in downtown Knowlton. I understand it. I mean, it's you know, not to pass up, but it's, you know, just the, I didn't really get to do a lot of things. You know, cute little stores, restaurants, you know, blah, 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 and yama, you know, that kind of thing. We stayed at another auberge, Auberge Lakeview Inn. There was no lake to view. I don't know what they were talking about. We don't even know. We were trying to figure out why they called it the Lakeview Inn, because since there was no lake. Now, I liked it, but it was like the room was, you know, compared to what we were just in. The room was kind of small, Victorian, but central air conditioning. Did I have a whirlpool? I think I had a whirlpool tub, but I'm not into that anyway. And, there we had a candlelit dinner in their authentic English pub. Let me see. Did I have duck? I think I passed up the duck because, you know, I thought I'd take a break. Yes, that is good, Donald. I don't remember what I ate. This is so hard. I'm talking about damn food here after, you know, stuffing myself tonight. And, okay, so that's... That was Monday, and then the next day was breakfast in the pub. I don't even know if I bothered to have, if I did, I don't even remember. I was probably so full from dinner. And from there, we went to the Saint Benoît du Lac Abbey. We went to the a monastery. Just for me. No, it was, but it was interesting. We got a tour from Father Bolduc, B-O-L-D-U-C. We got a tour of the monastery. It was a historic thing to do. It's, it was old, of course. No, it actually a lot of it wasn't old. A lot of it was like added on things from. Since like in 1950s, 60s, 70s, or whatever. But we walked around the whole place, and there were all these things, signs and pictures and stuff, telling you what everything was about, and you know, and so on and so forth. We did stop at one point. They were having a service, and we were listening to some of the. What you call that chant stuff. What do you call it? No, yeah, is that it? Yeah. In case anybody's wondering, like, I'm trying to ask Barbara, even though I can't hear her, or she can't answer me. Gregorian chant, is that what you said? Yeah, Gregorian chant. We listened to a little of that, and we went to the gift shop, of course. But the thing that was interesting about the gift shop is they were selling things that the monks make, made by monks stuff, including cheese. I don't know what else they were there. I know that they make cheeses. And I bought some of that cheese and some chocolate. And we left there, and it's time for dinner. Yes, it's time for dinner, thank God. You know, I think about half an hour went by. So we had dinner at the dining room in Lakeview Inn. I don't remember. I would have to look. I had a, I would have to look in my book. I wonder what's going on. It's like 8:48 right now, and so far, well, it can't be that anything's wrong about nobody being able to call in because, I mean, I could see that, you know, that I could, Barbara, I could see that you're listening. So, I don't know. Maybe everybody forgot. Maybe, I see a phone number. All right, let's see. Who the heck, who do I have on the phone? Who do I have here? Who do I have?
This is Matthew Krause.
Yes, okay. So let me tell you who we got here. This is the thing that I really wanted to talk about, how Ohio pulled it off. I saw the movie. I got to tell you, I watched the movie, and I wasn't surprised at all. But
okay.
I'll let you talk about it. Well, first of all, what I first want to ask you about this movie is, like, what made you decide to do it? And first tell us what this movie is about and why you decided to do it.
Okay. How Ohio Pulled It Off is an hour-long documentary about the about politics in Ohio, about the 2004 presidential election in Ohio, and subsequent events. As you know, Ohio played a big part in delivering the White House to George W. Bush, and there were quite a few things that went on there that probably affected the outcome, and so we basically approached it sort of after the fact. We wanted to know why things turned out as they did. Why did Bush win and Kerry lose? And so we started asking voters why they voted the way they did. And the strange thing was, we didn't talk to a lot of people who voted for Bush, or at least would acknowledge that, you know, in front of a camera. And the more we explored it, we discovered that, you know, maybe people voted one way, but perhaps the votes were counted another way, or maybe they weren't counted at all. So that was our initial motivation, was to figure out what happened and why. Ohio plays a pretty important role in the national political scene because it has 20 electoral votes, and you know, the president is not elected based on the popular result, like we saw in Florida in 2000. Right. So it really comes down to the electoral college and who can get those votes in their corner. And it seems like when it comes to politics, the parties will do almost anything to see that their candidate gets those votes.
Uh-huh. Now, can you just give us some examples, by the way, of, like, of the things that you found to have happened?
Well, for example, voters who had been registered to vote had been going to the same polling place for many years. They hadn't moved. There was no reason really for them to experience any difficulty on election day. They would go to their polling place and discover that their name was not in the poll book. And if you're not a registered voter, well, that makes things a little bit more difficult for you. That was one issue with voter registration, and the problem seemed to occur most often in urban areas where African Americans and other minorities live. So the problem really seemed to affect black people primarily, who tend to vote with the Democrats.
Uh-huh.
So this was unusual. At the time, in 2004, the Secretary of State, J. Kenneth Blackwell, he was a Republican, also co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign, and he made some decisions which probably favored Bush. And, you know, that's supposed to be a fairly nonpartisan role because the Secretary of State really oversees the election on a state level. Other issues were, there was a huge turnout of voters because there were extensive voter registration drives prior to the election. So a lot of people were really energized and went out to the polls on election day, and the polling places were not prepared for that. There were not enough voting machines to support the turnout, and so what you ended up getting was very long lines, like out the door into the street. So people ended up waiting for many hours, in some cases in inclement weather, you know, in the rain, to vote. And, you know, that's not really practical if you have to get back to your job or you have children or that kind of thing. So a lot of people probably showed up and waited and just, you know, had to go back to their life, so they couldn't cast their vote. And probably a lot of people turned up and saw these huge lines and got discouraged right there and just turned around. Another problem that was reported was that the with electronic voting machines, people would prepare their ballot, you know, and then review it when they were done and see that their selections had been changed by the computer, or machines would break down altogether. And so there are all kinds of problems that really made it difficult for people to get their vote cast, and made it likely that their vote may not have been counted as they intended.
So now, when this was done, this movie came out recently, right?
Well, actually, Merle, the broadcast premiere in the United States will be on Monday, October 6th on the documentary channel.
Oh, okay. So
it'll be 8 p.m. Eastern time.
Oh, okay. So again, so it's on the documentary channel,6th?
Yes, Monday, October 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Now, it's
okay.
It's played in a little bit in the United States. It played in a festival in Ohio, in Athens. That's where we showed it initially. And it's going to play in Kent, Ohio, this coming weekend, and also in Columbus in October. It's probably seen more play internationally. It's played in Paris at the International Human Rights Film Festival. It was broadcast on television in Croatia. And it was. It also played in Argentina. It was at the Buenos Aires Film Festival, and it was very well received there, and actually went on a traveling exhibition in Argentina. So the wheels are turning. We'd like to see it get more exposure in the United States, and so that's why we're very excited that the documentary channel has given us this opportunity.
Oh, yeah. What is your, do you think the same thing will happen in this election?
Well, it's possible. Anytime the margin is very close, you know, when the candidates, you know, we have two major parties, and the candidates are sort of 50-50 in the polls, and In that situation, it seems more likely that manipulation could affect the outcome, because you only really have to push it one way or another by a little bit in order to change the result. Now, that's not to say that if the election is a landslide, if people try to vote and they can't, that doesn't mean that's acceptable. But what we've seen, you know, in 2000, in 2004, was a very evenly divided popular vote, at least, you know, by the official count. And in that situation, it doesn't really take much to push the balance one way or another. And there really, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of action on the part of the government to really see that the problems of 2000 and 2004 have been addressed. There's been a lot of effort on the part of concerned citizens to bring the issue of election integrity to the table. But I think, generally speaking, our leaders are reluctant to acknowledge that there may be some potential weaknesses with the election system.
Yeah, or rigged.
Right, right.
Yeah.
In 2004, John Kerry conceded very, very quickly. Actually, before all of the votes had been counted in Ohio. And so we don't really see it as a one party or another necessarily being responsible. It's really both the Republicans and the Democrats, they essentially control the election system down to the county level. So if there's some misdoing or misdeeds by one party, you really have to have the other party allowing it to happen. So,
or maybe the other party not knowing that it's happening? Is that a possibility?
Well, it's possible. Although you would think that in a contest like the presidential race, they would really pull out all the stops in an effort to win. And there were definitely reports very, very early on of people having these problems, you know, at the polling places. I mean, there were problems with registration, you know, before Election Day. But in 2004 in Ohio, despite, you know, this public outcry, there wasn't really much effort on the part of the Democrats to look into it. They kind of packed up their bags and sent the lawyers home and kind of let it slide, so to speak. But the citizens got together,
right,
and did some, they held public hearings for the record where people told their stories of how they had tried to vote or had problems with their voter registration, so that, you know, at least there would be a record for future generations and for, you know, any potential legal action that could happen as a result of the events of Election Day. So really, it's kind of an issue of the, you know, is the government reflecting the acknowledging the concerns of the people, and in this case, probably not so much. In Ohio, there is a new Secretary of State, Jennifer Bruner, and I think she's doing a good job to try to restore integrity to the election system. But on a national level, it's definitely not an issue that's entered the discussion. And so it's hard to say, you know, if I would say that things haven't necessarily improved in terms of election integrity, you know.
Right. We also don't have like any particular one system happening at all polling places either.
Right. Right. That's true. It's very decentralized. You probably have you know, thousands of mini elections happening, you know, when we vote for the president, and then that all of those different results will eventually determine the winner. So it's it's a very decentralized system.
Well, I mean, and when I say, I mean, it also when I say different, it's like when I go to my polling place, that's their little flag, and I'm, you know, it's the old time machine, and it's the flag,
right,
and I push down the flag. But then there are other places that, you know, I understand the whatever papers and computer and, you know, all kinds of other things. That's what, you know, that's what I mean by that. So.
Right, yeah. That's true. In 2004, some people voted on punch cards, which was also a problem in some cases. And other people voted on touchscreen machines, and still others voted on what they call optical scan. So, yeah, there isn't really one standard at all in terms of the mechanics of the election. So that's probably adds to the confusion in terms of the implementation, you know.
That could I mean that I don't know that it'll ever be one particular standard of voting, and you know, and how it's controlled. I've had the experience of like I guess manning, you know, going to the polls and working, you know, and think and what I'm responsible for, you know, and how that works, and watching the numbers and watching, you know, things like that, which is interesting because I was looking at it like, well, can I cheat? I mean, do I have the ability to cheat? You know, I don't remember because that's what I was looking at, if I wanted to. But
no.
I think I remembered somebody had to then check something I did.
Right. That's a good point. You know, I think it's great that you were a poll worker. You know, this is a democracy, and our elections should really be a participatory experience. And so there is a movement, you know, really to try to maintain or go back to a system where the vote count is done in a public forum, you know, where people volunteers will come to the polling place or to the election board office and basically sit down and count the ballots together and, you know, kind of keep an eye on each other to make sure everything's above board.
Right.
But that sort of that kind of participation really disappears when we start dealing with electronic voting machines. Basically, you know, the voters enter their selections, and then at the end of the day, the computer spits out a number, and they kind of just say that's who won. There's not really that we become disconnected from the process, and we all, you know, those of us who have any experience with computers know that they're not perfect machines. They're programmed by human beings who, you know, are who can make mistakes, or who can even, you know, take action to, you know, adjust the numbers one way or another.
Right.
In fact, some of the most vocal opponents of electronic voting machines come from the computer programming community. You know, the same people that create the software for ATMs and defense systems are saying that really the technology is not appropriate for something as sacred as our vote. You know, it's not that perfect, so to speak.
Right.
And so that's really something to think about.
Oh, sure. Did you see that movie, Man of the Year? with
I did not.
Robin Williams?
I'll have to check that one out.
You have to check that out because then that'll really interest you. What the story revolved around is a guy, Robin Williams, is a plays a comedian, but he does a he's a political comedian. And
mm-hmm.
so people turn around and say to him, you should run for office. So he decides to run for office for president. And he's going against the two other guys, I guess one who was trying to get reelected and then someone new or whatever. And what happened is that he winds up getting elected, but he winds up getting elected because of a problem with the computers. And the story happens to be that this particular woman finds where the problem is, and the computer company doesn't want her to, you know, give out that information that it's their fault, you know. So they're after her to kill her. But it's interesting. I mean, you know, to know that you just never know what why somebody gets into office.
Right. Well, the software that runs these voting machines is a trade secret. It's proprietary information.
Mm-hmm.
So the companies that manufacture these machines do not allow the product really to be subject to public scrutiny.
Right.
And there have been a few instances where professors and researchers have gotten their hands on the machine and were able to dissect them. And in those cases, they did find some serious flaws. But as far as the electronic voting goes, it's definitely an imperfect system. Ironically, part of the reason that we have these systems being implemented is due to legislation called the Help America Vote Act. And it sounds good on its face, but really what it was an effort to implement these electronic voting systems before they were really ready for prime time. I mean, they may never really be ready, you know, for prime time, depending on your point of view. But at present, a lot of people are going to be using them, and I think that's definitely a subject of concern. I mean, there are other issues too in terms of, you know, like I said, in terms of people having their registrations invalidated. One technique that's been utilized is they'll send a piece of mail to the voter, and if for some reason the voter doesn't receive the mail and it's returned, that is used as a justification for invalidating the voter registration. There are a lot of different techniques to make it difficult for people to have their voice heard. And that's definitely still happening today. I mean, 2004 is history, but it's recent history. And there are a lot of lessons to be learned from that and from 2000. Those elections were not clean cut, so to speak. And chances are there's going to be some problems in 2008. You know, hopefully the people will be diligent. I think people are going to be out there observing the polls. Probably there's going to be some parallel elections where people will be polling voters as they come out of the polling place, just to kind of run a check on that, on the system, and make sure that the votes are being counted as the voters intended. So we'll see what happens, Merle.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. I do think it really should be an issue that it's more widely discussed in the media. It seems like we kind of get sidetracked by the candidates and their personalities and their personal issues. When, I mean, really the foundations of democracy are potentially at risk. But, you know, that's maybe a little bit too uncomfortable for us to talk about on the morning news.
Right.
I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to kind of share an interesting thing that happened with me. This is why I was interested in this. This was back in the 1980s that I had this opportunity, so to speak. I had this opportunity to go to a hotel, the Hotel de Coronado, two nights, three nights, whatever it is, having to do with investing, you know. And I just, and I went, and they didn't ask me anything about my political affiliation. They basically, as I found out prior to going, I had to do with investing in silver. And then when I arrived there, what they were talking about was buying silver bars and burying it. And I thought, what are they talking about? And part of the thing is you had to listen to all the seminars. And after they, you know, the first seminar, we took a break. I, you know, went to the back of the room, and there were all these books there on Republican conservatives. And they wanted us to take the books. They were free, read it, you know. And as this thing is going on, they're talking about things like they were talking about Captain Red McDaniels, who was a POW. They were giving out his book. They were talking about how the Republicans would pay $1 million for each POW they can get home, you know. And I'm kind of really listening to this, and I'm thinking, what did all this have to do with silver? Why didn't they, you know? And I don't remember who spoke, but it was the wife of a senator who spoke about something there. And in the back of my head, I'm remembering something having to do with McCain with this thing. And what had happened, I didn't invest because I thought, I don't understand, you know, why they're doing this. And but I, from what I heard, it turned out to be a scam. So what had gone in the back of my head, not at the time, but as time went on and whatever, especially now with McCain running, is I thought, what would the Republicans do with money? What would they buy? And this mm-hmm. is like, that's why when I watched this and I thought, you know, what would they, who would they pay money for to do what? To get what they want. And now are we, you know, is this going to happen now? You know, what's going to happen now? Is I don't know. I don't trust it. I don't trust the election at all. So
well, there's a curious parallel. You know, the past week or so, you know, what's really come to the, you know, to our attention is the fact that our economy is way out of balance.
Yeah.
And it seems sort of, for those of us who are, you know, just reading the newspaper or watching the news, it's kind of a surprise because, you know, for a long time we heard that the economy was in good shape, you know, unemployment's under control and all this kind of, you know, rhetoric about how, you know, our system is really untouchable. And then, as it turns out, the reality is much different. You know, we're facing a very serious problem, and I feel like there's a certain analogy to be drawn with the election system, because there's this sense that, at least from our leaders, and a lot of times from the mainstream pundits, that, you know, this is the greatest system on earth, and there's really no problem that's going to affect that. And now this may be the greatest system on earth. I guess that's a subject for a different debate. But my point is that there are definitely some cracks below the surface that we may not want to acknowledge, and we really need to confront that, you know, as we move forward. I mean, in this election and certainly in future elections, because when it comes to politics, it really doesn't matter how you win. It's that you win.
Right.
And,
uh-huh.
You know, in 2000, George W. Bush took the presidency, but, I mean, officially lost the popular vote, which
right.
is a very unusual result. And in 2004, I think that they wanted to avoid that potential embarrassment. And so the popular vote, or at least the results thereof in Ohio, was manipulated in a sense, in that they wanted to make the official tally appear as if George Bush had taken the popular vote and therefore deserved the electoral votes. But if you talk to the people on the street and you look at the records, whether or not he deserved those electoral votes is definitely an open question. And I don't know that we've made too much progress officially since then. Although I do think there have been a lot of efforts on the part of citizens and activists and journalists to get the story out and make people aware. And I think a lot of citizens are kind of open to the idea that, you know, politics is a pretty crooked game, and we got to watch out for our rights, because if we're not keeping an eye on the system and making sure that it's working as it should, well, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, we can look at the economy, you know, and draw that parallel.
I mean, so, the thing that I don't seem to like to get, I mean, unless, you know, something that I don't remember, mm-hmm. how is it that all of a sudden, like, you're getting the candidates involved as if they're already in office? I mean, I don't understand that they're going to talk with Bush about something that Bush screwed up. I'm sorry, but it's his administration. We don't know what he did. Everybody's going to say somebody else did it. But as far as I'm concerned, well, but the thing is, I don't understand. I mean, they're going, let's, you know, we should debate. Yeah, they should debate. But all of a sudden, McCain is going, no, I don't want to debate. We got to do
right.
this. We got to go to the White House. Excuse me? Why? You president? Are you, you know, like, you know, you're not in office yet. Why would you?
Right.
Why would they, you know, and of course, so Obama's not going to turn around and say, screw you. You know, I he can't debate himself. So it makes me wonder if McCain is just going to take over, you know, trying to just take over the Bush spot and that's it.
Well, there is a curious reluctance to reveal his position. I mean, that's probably a political move. I mean, we need to talk about a lot of issues, even though, you know, Washington seems to be making some progress on the economy issue with or without the presidential candidates. Now, I can understand that they should participate because really they're the ones who are going to be handed the problem when one of them is inaugurated. But it's definitely very political.
Yeah. I mean, what I find odd also is that, I mean, Bush did this whole thing about giving money to people, giving back money, some money back to people so we can buy. And then all of a sudden mm-hmm. now we turn around, we have the money to buy. Now we're turning around, oh, by the way, we're having this crisis now. You can't
right.
buy.
Well, it's very unusual. I think most people I've talked to are very surprised, angry, definitely not happy about the current state of affairs. And, you know, I think that the government is never going to admit that it's made a mistake or that things are not peaches and cream. The same thing goes for elections. You know,
Right.
There is no, even if you could definitively prove that Bush did not deserve the presidency, there's no mechanism in place to retroactively, you know, to go back and say, well, we made a mistake, you know, the results were flawed, I mean, aside from impeachment. So basically, once you win the presidency, you know, by whatever means, there's no going back. I mean, people, and that seemed to be the case in 2004, you know, once the win was declared, the media ran with it, you know, the voices that were saying, but hey, wait a minute, we, you know, out here in Ohio, we're still voting and you're declaring the winner.
Right.
They were kind of overshadowed by the rush to declare a winner. And that's a good point, because, you know, you'd think that for the decision for that, decides the, basically the leader of the most popular or most powerful country in the world, we could probably take a few days to count the votes and figure it out. But
right.
There's definitely a push, I think, by the media and probably by, you know, the parties to come to a conclusion very quickly. And I think that's at the expense of the voters, really.
Right. The thing, that's one of the things I don't understand, like, as I'm watching the TV, say, like, okay, the polls are closed, 35% of the vote is in, and we're projecting whatever. And I'm going, I don't understand. It's only 35%. Why don't you wait till, let's get closer to 100% before anybody
right.
projects anything? That it's like you're denying that anything else can happen.
Right. There's definitely a rush to pick a winner. I mean, we see that even now. We focus more on the daily poll results than the issues that we really should be talking about. I mean, it's really, it's a little bit scary in some respects, because certain candidates really haven't come forward to tell the people what they really think. And the media is generally more concerned with relatively superficial topics, like who's got, you know, 2% more today than yesterday. So I think that the people are smarter than that. You know, if you talk to, you know, almost anybody, they've got real concerns that they know are not being addressed. And I think the government, you know, and our leaders, you know, really need to acknowledge that the people, you know, are elected them or tried to, and that they're here to represent us and our interests. And, you know, whether or not that's actually the case at this point in history is an open question. So, I mean, these are all the issues that come up in our movie. We tried to give it a kind of a happy ending, in that, you know, it can be a little bit depressing if you think about it too much. But, you know, this country is really, it's built on the efforts of the people to make things right.
Right,
and
yeah.
I think that is important when you're thinking about, you know, elections or the economy or, you know, any problem that we face, is that most of us get up every day and try to do the right thing. You know, hopefully one of these days we'll get the government in line and they'll also try to do the right thing on our behalf. But I mean, I guess that's where we're at the moment.
So, okay, so again, this movie, How Ohio Pulled It Off, October 6th, Monday, October 6th, on the...
on the documentary channel.
The documentary
channel. 8 p.m. Eastern. That's right.
Okay.
Our website is ohiopulleditoff.com. You can get more information there. about screening and events. And hopefully some listeners out there will be able to catch the U.S. broadcast premiere, which we're very excited about. It's a great opportunity. You don't have to be a Democrat alone to watch the movie. I think we kind of take jabs at both sides because really both parties are responsible for the health of our democracy. You know, and if it wasn't, one side, it would probably be the other trying to take advantage of some loophole in the system. So it's helpful to keep an open mind and look at the facts and make your own decision.
Well, it'll be quite interesting. I'm going to want to talk to you after the elections to see.
Okay.
What your, you know, to get feedback on what you heard or what you thought happened or what might have been happening or, you know, as far as with the places.
Right. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. I want to have you on again to say, okay, so now, you know, what did you think of this election? Or did you see anything? And if not, you know, are you going to explore it for another, you know, documentary?
Right, we'll have to wait and see what the people on the ground say. That, you know, when the voters go to vote, we'll find out what their experience is like, and you know, hopefully things will go as they should. But I think that there's always the possibility that somebody is going to get shut out, and that's something we want to avoid. Because every vote is supposed to count, whether or not it really does is another story.
Okay. Well, it looks like the show is about to end, so I'll be in touch with you, and I hope everybody really gets to see this. And I'll probably get into the newspaper too, all about this. As well.
Well, thanks for talking with me, Marilla. It's been a great pleasure.
And it's a great pleasure to have somebody with some interesting info, too. By the way, where are you calling from? Where are you living? What?
I'm in New York City at the moment.
Oh, you're in New York City. Oh, okay.
Not far from you at the moment.
Oh, okay. All right. So, I'll be in touch with you, and we'll see what happens in the future.
Okay, very good.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Matthew.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Well, next week's show, I'm not sure yet. We didn't have certain callers on this one's show, so I'm going to end it, and I'm going to go to the rain. I'm going to go to the rain restaurant. Have a dessert and tea, listen to some music, and I'll see everybody next week. I'll hear everybody. You'll hear me. Oh, look who's here. She followed me. Oh, goodness. Come in here. Say hello to everyone. Say goodbye to everyone. I know. I know you're the host of the show. I understand.